Good morning, good afternoon, perhaps good evening. We are back in the Philadelphia Sports Week podcast. I am Dave Murphy, your host for the next 45 minutes, where we will be running through everything that matters in the state of Philadelphia sports. In other words, your fighting Philadelphia Phillies. But first, I got to talk about how this podcast came together, this episode in particular, because earlier today, I spent an unhealthy amount of time trying to come up with a suitable way to introduce what you're about to hear over the next 45 minutes to an hour. And I'll be honest, I struggled. I've probably spent 75% of my time today trying to come up with an adequate prelude to the brilliance that you're about to hear from some of my colleagues at the Daily News, guys like Rich Hoffman, guys like Les Bowen, guys like Will Bunch, guys like Sam Donnellan, guys like Marcus Hayes. And I failed. All afternoon, I wrote and I erased, typed and deleted, recorded and recorded again. I bounced it off of Siri.
Here are directions to Walmart.
She didn't help me out. I was on my own. And I'm racking my brain here. And I'm thinking, what would they do? History's greatest speakers, what would they do? Sitting behind a microphone, trying to introduce a podcast that will essentially set up the upcoming baseball season. What words would they use? I thought about Socrates. Wisdom begins in wonder. I thought about Whitman. Be curious, not judgmental.
Here are directions to Walmart.
I thought about dropping Siri in the toilet.
Sorry, I don't understand.
Anyway, I started to realize that history's greatest speakers, history's greatest minds, all have an ability to take this complex, multidimensional, philosophical argument and boil it down into four or five or six words that have the same impact as 400, 500, or 600 would out of you or I. And that's when it hit me. Boom. And I had to laugh at myself. I said, self, you, my friend, are a fool. Because all this time you are searching for words, and these words have already been said. Not only have they already been said, they've been said in your own town, in your own city, the place where you are sitting right now. The cradle of liberty. The birthplace of freedom. The city of brotherly love. Right here. One man. One sentence. Four little words. But the greatest. And I mean greatest. Of messages.
We talking about practice.
That's right. Phillies practice begins this week in Clearwater, Florida, February 19th, first workout for pitchers and catchers. I will be heading down on Thursday. Hopefully we'll get into town on Friday. Yes, I'm driving. Don't ask why. Point is, baseball season begins. 2012 officially begins this week. I talked to Charlie Manuel 2 weeks ago at the Philadelphia Sports Writers Association banquet, and let me tell you, Big Chuck is fired up. And I'm sure all of you feel the same way, and that's why you're listening today. And I hope you will not be disappointed, because we've got a ton of Phillies talk on tap in a new segment I'm unveiling called Over Under. Rich Hoffman, Marcus Hayes, and Sam Donnellan, all colleagues of mine at the Daily News, I'm going to give them a list of categories and a list of corresponding over-unders, and they're going to tell me whether they think the end result will be over or under. And let me tell you something, Rich Hoffman and Sam Donnellan, they're very bullish on this Philly season. They are Facebook bullish on this Philly season. 11 wins in the postseason bullish on this Philly season. Question, is Rich Hoffman Warren Buffett or is Rich Hoffman Lenny Dykstra? That's a big question. And I am not sure that I can give you an honest answer. Really, more than any other season, I think this one depends on the answer to a number of big health question marks. And I know you can say the same thing about just about every team in the major leagues, but the Phillies have so many of them, even putting aside Ryan Howard, it's impossible to tell which direction this season will go. Would it surprise me if they win the World Series? Absolutely not. Would it surprise me if they win 100 games? Absolutely not. But would it surprise me if they once again enter the trade deadline needing to make a move to stabilize things? No. You have heard Ruben Amaro Jr. repeatedly say, look, you can't predict injuries. We'd be great if it wasn't for the injuries. We've had bad luck. And he's right. But while you can't predict injuries, you can minimize your risk against them. And right now, it's really tough to describe the Philly situation as anything less than perilous. I mean, let's put Ryan Howard aside for a second. You can't predict injuries. But can you not predict that a 36-year-old third baseman who has missed at least 20 games in four of the last five seasons, can you not predict that he has a greater chance of missing significant time than your average ball player? Can you not predict that a second baseman who has missed at least 30 games in three of the last five seasons, including 47 in 2010 and 59 in 2011, can you not predict that he has a chance or a greater chance of missing significant time than the average ball player? Can you not say that a starting pitcher who has made just eight starts in 2011 and who never really figured out what was wrong with his elbow, can you not say that he's a big health question mark? Can you not say the same thing about a 39-year-old reliever who missed the last 5 months of 2011 and is coming off major elbow surgery? I think you can say all of that. And I think you can say the Phillies face very unpredictable situations with regards to Chase Utley, with regards to Placido Polanco, with regards to Joe Blanton, and with regards to Jose Contreras. Don't get me wrong. A lot can go right for this Phillies team, and we'll break all of that down. And as I said, Rich Hoffman and Sam Donnell, they're looking on the bright side of life. Marcus Hayes, I'm not sure what he's looking at. But before we get into that, and I promise we'll get into that within the next minute, let me just encourage you to stick around for the last half of the podcast when I will sit down with Les Bowen and talk about the Todd Bowles, Juan Castillo situation. He will explain what he thinks Todd Bowles is doing here and what, if any, role he will have in calling the Eagles defense. Finally, we will sit down with Daily News senior writer Will Bunch, who normally dabbles more in politics and government than sports, but he has written a book on the 1948 NFL championship game featuring your Philadelphia Eagles and one of the all-time greats, Steve Van Buren. And we will talk about that game and Steve Van Buren, but more interestingly, we are going to talk about life in post-World War II Philadelphia, and we're going to talk about the evolution of the psyche of the Philadelphia sports fan from that 1948 championship game to today. But first, let's talk baseball.
Rich Hoffman.
Cole Hamels' next contract, length, over under of 5.5 years.
I'm going to say under.
Why?
Because that's the line I think they're going to draw, and they're going to get killed on the money number. But I think the Phillies will attempt to make their stand at 5 years.
Then I'll say you're probably going to say over to this next one. Average annual salary of Cole Hamels next deal over under $20.1 million.
I'm going to say over because money is not so meaningless. It's not so meaningful to them. I don't think. The years are the thing that scares them, and so they'll throw a lot of money out.
Yeah, David Montgomery, he's like Scrooge McDuck, swimming in his money pit. Don't you think he has one of those in his house somewhere? I could picture it. You Penn guys, you guys all have those things installed.
Exactly right.
It's like house, finished basement, panic room, money pit, gold brick driveway. Where are you at?
I gotta tell you, I mean, the Wharton School does not claim me as an alum, and they do not brag about me in the alumni magazine, I can tell you.
Do you even get a mention?
No.
Sam Donnellan.
Cole Hamels' next contract, over under 5.5 years.
I'm gonna say it's over. I'm gonna say they're not gonna be able to get him for less than that.
Cole Hamels' next average annual salary over under $20.1 million.
And I would say that has to be if you believe he's gonna have a good year, which I do. That's gonna be an over.
Marcus Hayes.
Marcus, Cole Hamels' next contract, 5.5 years, over or under?
Under, absolutely under. Maybe, I don't know. What do you think? 3 years and $60 million from a team to be named later.
Yeah, you think he'll only get three, huh?
I do. I don't think anybody's going to jump in with both feet. I think the perception of Cole here in Philadelphia is different from the perception of Cole elsewhere. I don't think that people see him as a Cliff Lee or a CeCe Sabathia. I think they see him as a very, very good number two, but not a frontline ace number one. And honestly, he's never been able to prove that he was by himself for an entire year.
Well, we'll talk about that later because I disagree with you. Cole Hamels, next average annual salary, $20.1 million over or under?
I think it's going to be 20. I think it's going to be slightly under, and I think it'd be about right. I think that's what he's worth, and it won't be his last contract. So
I think the Yankees are going to back up the Brinks truck for him. I really do.
Well, you know, they've had good success with lefties in the past. I mean, Pettit and then CeCe. You know, you can't argue with their past success, and they seem to be able to take care of their guys. You know, Cole might do just fine in New York as the guy with the weight of the city on his shoulder.
Yeah, I think the bigger question would be health, if anything. You know.
Yeah, I agree, and you know, Cole has not been hurt, which is kind of a blessing and a curse, because with pitchers, you know they're going to get hurt at some point, and that was the knock on CeCe. That's why CeCe probably didn't have as many people chasing him as you might think. But I think a lot of people were thinking, with all that extra weight and, you know, him getting up there in innings and advancing in age, that, oh, you know, it's inevitable. But he's proven them wrong to this point.
But he still got paid. He got paid.
He got paid by the Yankees.
He got P-A-Y-E-D.
Yep. But Johan Santana got paid too, and then he got hurt.
Yeah. But you think these GMs will learn a lesson?
I don't know. I don't think they'll learn a lesson as far as those two guys go. But, you know, let's be honest. Those two guys had probably done a little bit more and were a little bit higher profile and a different type of person and pitcher than Cole Hamels has been to this point. I mean, Cole Hamels goes out and wins 25 games this year and wins the Cy Young Award, the first of many he expects and hopes to win. Then the conversation's different. But if he has a similar year to the years that he's had the last couple, which have been very, very good years, but they haven't been Cliff Lee years, they haven't been Roy Oswalt years, they haven't been Cy Young Award candidate years.
All right, I got to stop it right there. Marcus, listen, I know this isn't fair to you because we talked about 24 hours ago and you did not have the opportunity to pause time and fact check yourself. But I got to do it for you because, well, let's just read the numbers and let them marinate for a little bit. Over the last 2 years, among major league starters, 86 of them who have started at least 50 games, Cole Hamels ranks 7th in earned run average, a 2.92 ERA. Granted, Roy Halladay ranks 1st with a 2.40 ERA. Cliff Lee ranks 4th with a 2.77 ERA. But Cole Hamels is just 3 slots behind Mr. Cliff Lee, allowing 0.15 earned runs more per 9 innings than Mr. Lee. He's made 4 more starts than Lee, pitched 21 fewer innings. And yes, the rest of his stats pale to Cliff Lee. But look at them in the context of the rest of the game. Hamels has a 3.86 strikeout per walk ratio. That ranks 5th. Not 1st or 2nd, like Lee and Halladay, but 5th among all starters. Not just free agent starters, not just free agent lefty starters, and not just free agent lefty starters who are 26, 27 years old during that time frame. All starters. Young, old, fat, skinny, gritty, pretty. 5th. 5th. 8.58 strikeouts per 9 innings. 14th in the majors. Better than Mr. Cliff Lee and Mr. Roy Halladay. Walks, no one's going to beat Lee and Halladay. They tied 1.21 walks per 9 innings for the major league lead over the last 2 years. But walks and hits per 9, 1.081. Hamels is 6th, 1.041. Halladay is 4th, and 1.016. Lee is 1st. So yes, Cole Hamels, not Cliff Lee. Not yet. Not Roy Halladay. Few people ever will be. But we need to recalibrate our image of Cole Hamels. Frankly, I think the image was mistaken to begin with. This guy's a competitor. He might not look like a horse, but he pitches like one. He's got numbers like one. And most importantly, he's going to be a free agent like one. And he's going to have to be paid like one. And if the Phillies don't do it, I guarantee you somebody will. Yankees, money, look. Why do you think they're doing everything in their power to get rid of A.J. Burnett, to shed salary this year? Because they can't wait. They cannot wait to spend money. And if Cole Hamels hits the free agent market, There is no way the Phillies outbid the Yankees. No way. Mark it down. Mark it down. They will not outbid the Yankees. They will not be able to. They will not have the stomach for it, which is why they need to sign him tomorrow. Probably not tomorrow. By the All-Star break. It really doesn't do them any good to sign him before opening day, because you might as well wait and see if he stays healthy for spring training. But if you want to keep Cole Hamels off the market, midway through the season is it. Because at that point, if you're Hamels, why would you not chance 14 more starts to stay healthy if it means the Yankees are going to be bidding against the Phillies in the free agent market? You want to talk about Sabathia? We can talk about Sabathia. Hamels, 2.92 ERA last 2 years. Sabathia, 2 years before he hit free agency, 2.95 ERA. Granted, Sabathia is an innings eater. He's an everything eater, as a matter of fact. 69 starts, 494 innings. Hamels, well behind that. But both are 26 and 27 in those 2 years. Hamels will be 29 when he hits free agency. Sabathia, 28. Otherwise, why shouldn't Cole Hamels expect CC Sabathia money? Because the market has changed. All right, I'll give you that. Keep in mind what the Yankees were willing to bid for Cliff Lee, who was 3 years older than Cole Hamels will be. And, frankly, has missed more time due to injury over the last 3 or 4 seasons than Cole Hamels. So, I personally don't get the logic. And again, I realize this is unfair. I should have had these numbers ready when I talked to Marcus. But I gotta set the record straight. So anyway, Marcus, I love you. Please proceed.
They've been very good years, but he hasn't shown in his career that he's going to be anything but what he's been so far. And I don't know that even the Yankees, I don't know that they're, you know, eager to commit that much more salary, because at some point the money has to stop, right?
Well, we're going to, you know what, we're going to end up putting a little wager on this, because I would probably give you 75-1 odds that he would get maybe, probably not twice, but I would bet you, I don't know what it can't. I mean, the bet could not involve me running around in a thong or eating any insects. But anything else is on the table, because I am that confident that he will get. I think you're right on with the 20 million mark. But I think 5-100 is where it starts.
Rich Hoffman.
What about the Phillies regular season win total? And I feel like I made this a little low because everyone's saying over, except for Marcus, of course. He thinks they're going to win 25 games next year.
Yeah.
97.5. And I say this.
Oh, I saw under. Under.
100? Do you think it's...
Under. Under 97.
Oh, under. Okay. I thought you said 100. 100.
No, I say, I'm saying like 4, 5, 6 in there.
Let me ask you this then. This is a pretty mind-boggling stat, considering the fact that it goes back through the 2006 season. They've won at least 41 games against the division every year since 2006. Do you think they do that again this year? It's been between 41 and 49.
I think the division's harder. That seems obvious to me. I think it benefits them, though, in an odd way.
In terms of comparing
they won't be able to go to sleep. I mean, they'll have to play all year, and I think that'll help them. I mean, I think they have a tendency to wander a little bit, and they have a history of telling people, don't worry, we'll be there when it matters. I think it would be better if it mattered all summer. So I think they will win fewer than they typically do in a division, but I think it'll get them right.
Last year they played 59 games against teams with winning records. That was the fourth fewest in baseball. In 2010, 68, which was the ninth fewest in baseball. So, yeah, they have not played a ton of games against quality competition. I think that hurt them in the playoffs.
What did you read Matt Gelt today?
No.
where he thought he seems to think the Braves are the main competition.
I disagree.
Who do you think is?
I think the Marlins are.
Yeah, I kind of agree with him a little bit. I don't know. I like the bullpen, and I think Chipper might have one more run in him.
Yeah,
I might be totally wrong, but
now I will qualify that by saying that I am pessimistic on. Put it this way, I don't like the smoke signals that have been coming out about Tommy Hansen's health. I feel like young pitchers, when you start to talk about their shoulders and you start to downplay shoulders, that always inevitably ends up in disaster. See Josh Johnson in 2011. And I don't know that they can, bullpen or no bullpen, I don't know that they can come close to touching the Phillies if Tommy Hansen is not the Tommy Hansen of old. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I get what you're saying.
He has been. There's been a lot of mystery surrounding his shoulder dating back to last season, and I just think I don't like the way that's going. But if he's healthy, and Jurgens is healthy, who's also battled injuries, and they're certainly they have the pitching. But I just think the Braves faded last year, and I think the Marlins are on the rise. And if Josh Johnson remains healthy, which again is no sure thing. I go Marlins.
Sam Dinellen.
Phillies regular season win total, 97.5.
I'm going to say it'll have to be over. I'll say it's over.
How far over?
By one or two.
Okay. How about
99. How's that? How about 99?
How about the Phillies postseason? I'll let you. I will give you the freedom to change that in between now and the start of the regular season. It's non. Okay. This is non-binding. Over/under is non-binding.
Okay. Marcus Hayes.
My next question to you is: Phillies regular season win total 97.5. And keep in mind they have won at least 40 games against the division going back through 2006. 97.5. The over/under. I'm putting it at.
I gotta say 95. I think it's going to be slightly under.
Because the of the division.
Roy Oswalt's a very good pitcher, and he's not going to be there. And the division is better. And they're not going to have the bopper for the first month. I mean,
first two months, I would say, at least.
Okay, fine. They built this entire franchise around Ryan Howard.
Right.
You know, you can say, well, he's not the best player on the team. He's not the best hitter on the team. Whatever. When he's out of the lineup, it's a different club, and it psychologically affects the hitters. I mean, it psychologically affects the pitchers. It certainly affects how guys are pitched. You know, the great wins above replacements stat, there was a debate before Ryan Howard got hurt and missed a few games this past season about, you know, whether Chase Utley being out or Placido Polanco being out, wins above replacement, yada, yada, yada. And there was I don't know if you remember last year, there was a piece in the New York Times where it, you know, posited that, you know, they could lose Ryan Howard and replace him with Ross Glode. And it would be less of a wins above replacement issue than losing Chase Utley or Placido Polanco, which is not to say that Placido Polanco and Chase Utley aren't missed, but they won 102 games, and they were worst last year without Ryan Howard.
Mm-hmm.
Other factors might have factored into it, but Ryan Howard not being there, to me, for the first month, to me, cost them 3 games a month, and that knocks them below 100.
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually just started looking at this last night because it's really hard to tell. Because Ryan Howard has missed so little time over the course of his career, last year they were 7-9 in the 16 starts that he did not make. The year before that, they were 14-5 in the 19 starts that he did not make. But really, he has played almost exclusively 140, 145, 150, 155 games a season. He has not had those long extended absences that Utley has, that Polanco has, that Rollins has. And that more than anything is probably the storyline of the first half of this season, to see once and for all which side was right.
Mm-hmm.
The people
yeah,
who say,
right.
Hey, you know what? We need Ryan Howard more than we need anybody else in that lineup, or the people who say Chase Utley's the man, Jimmy Rollins is the man, heck, even Placido Polanco is the man before Ryan Howard. I think we're going to see that. And the one area I agree with you on is they just don't have that power anymore from anybody else.
Nope.
You know,
and but you know what? It's funny. Each of the three guys you talked about, Jimmy, Chase, and Placido Polanco, they could each hit, you know, 310 and score, you know, 20 right. runs apiece in the first month of the season. And it's a different team, but it's still a team that can score a lot of runs and score a lot of runs in bunches, especially when they hit intelligently. And, you know, it's just going to be interesting to see who the pitchers target
mm-hmm.
when Ryan's gone.
Yeah, I mean, it's the one area that wins. I'm a little more forward thinking than a lot of people when it comes to stats, but the one hesitancy I have about wins above replacement is that it doesn't count driving in runs as a skill. And I realize it's not as big of a skill as a lot of people make it. A lot of it's just situational. But Ryan Howard, year in and year out, finishes in the top 10 in percentage of runners driven home. And more than anything, he on a declining team that really is not getting the power it used to get out of Chase Utley, out of, I don't even know who's left. You know, I mean, obviously Pence and Victorino you factor in, but really Howard is the slugger in that lineup, and I don't know who they replace him with. I mean, you can't tell me Lance Nix, really. If Chase Utley does not magically become the Chase Utley of 2008 or Jimmy Rollins, the Jimmy Rollins of 2007, I don't know that the Phillies even know how much they need John Mayberry Jr. to be the man they hope he is, you know? Otherwise, that lineup is falling off a cliff.
Yeah, I really root for him. It'll be interesting. I hope he has a sort of chooch-like coming out party where he carries the team for, you know, a couple of weeks in April and maybe a week in May and really, you know, produces and gets a little confidence and, you know, sort of has a Jason Worth kind of year where he can fly a little bit below the radar but have a little bit of weight put on and see what he does. You know, I think he's an excellent athlete, and I think that he's a smart enough guy to learn to hit, to be a better cerebral hitter than Worth was, you know.
Rich Hoffman.
All right, hey, what's next on your fabulous list there? Because I really like the game. I do.
Yeah. All right. Postseason win total, Phillies, 2.5 games.
Postseason win total, Phillies, 2.5 games. Over.
How many over?
I'm thinking maybe 11.
11? That would mean parade.
Right. I think there's a chance.
What?
I've never picked them either.
I was going to say, in fairness, you've picked the same thing for the last 4 years.
I've never picked them.
Wow.
I just think, you know, maybe it's just the thought is I don't personally want to have to deal with, you know, what happens when they don't win. But no, I think they will benefit from the competition. But again, it's too early to make that prediction. There's a long way to go, but I'm going to say over.
Sam Dinellan.
Phillies postseason win total, 2.5 games.
Phillies postseason win total of 2.5. It's going to be over. I think they're going to get through that round.
Okay. What about in the second round? What 3.5? If you put it at 3.5, what would their win total be in the NLCS?
Yeah, I'm going to be an optimist. I'm going to say they're going to get to the World Series. I mean, I still think they're the best team, even though everybody else has improved.
Hey, why not?
Which is probably your reference to that. I'm probably over too high with the 99 because the other two teams have gotten better.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't looked at it close enough, but I'm very interested to see how they respond to the Marlins and even the Nationals now. It's funny that I mean both teams added not just pitchers but left-handed pitchers Mark Buehrle and Gio Gonzalez. So not that that's the weakness that it once was for them, particularly in the early part of the season when Ryan Howard is out, but it's going to be very interesting to see. No,
right? Yeah, the only thing that we keep underestimating, which the Phillies really showed us last year, is depth. I mean, the Phillies can take hits.
Yep.
You know, or could last year. You know, they certainly took enough hits that they shouldn't have won 102 games if they were any other team in the league. But they have pretty good depth. So,
but how do you think their depth?
And it seems like the Marlins always take hits. You know, we always think they're going to do much better than they do.
Yeah, it's interesting. I go both ways because you got to remember Roy Oswalt was here last year. Do they sustain the loss of a Joe Blanton without Roy Oswalt?
Right, but then he disappeared for a couple of months.
Right.
I mean, if Vance Worley doesn't do it, doesn't astound us. Where are they? You know, they're not at 102.
Well, I guess the point is they lost probably, what, 35 starts last year from the top four in their rotation. Can they afford to take that hit this year?
Yeah, good question, because they're not as deep.
Right.
Yeah, but, I mean, but if Blanton comes back, you know, in his so-called salary drive year and pitches like a three-starter, which you and I have occasionally argued that he could be, you know, or at least a four, yep, then you're in okay shape.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the fascinating thing is there's so many health questions about so many key contributors. I mean, is Jose Contreras going to be healthy? Is Joe Blanton going to be healthy? Is Chase Utley going to be healthy? Is Ryan Howard going to be healthy? You know, it can go so many
but
different...
But is Contreras that dependent? The rest of them, I'm with you. But, I mean, I'm thinking that anything they get from him is a plus. Do you really think he's...
Yeah, he's obviously... I think they would rather have Joe Blanton healthy for an entire season than Jose Contreras. But I think... If Contreras is healthy, that bullpen is pretty damn deep, right?
Right. Presuming that Papelbon is, you know, is not on his ledge legs there, you know, that they're not getting a guy who's, you know, just throwing himself. He's, you know, everybody in New England says to me all the time that the thing that's always scared you about him was every time he throws it, he looks like, you know, kind of like Billy Wagner. It looks like every effort of his body is going into it.
Yeah, and that's why I was surprised and I would have signed Ryan Madsen even to a similar contract, just because, I mean, Papelbon throws 70% fastball,
right?
You know, and
right.
You know, we have seen power pitchers decline in the past, you know, and I'm of the firm belief that every organization knows its players better than any other organization. And it tells you something that the Red Sox let Papelbon walk, even though it was for a monster deal. And that concludes the baseball portion of our program. One final thought. Playing around with baseball reference the other day, top 10 starters in ERA during the 2007-2008 seasons. That's 2007-2008 combined, the top 10 starting pitchers in terms of ERA. On that list, Jake Peavy, 28 years old when he had surgery. Johan Santana, 31 years old when he had surgery in 2010. Brandon Webb, 30 years old when he had surgery in 2009. And Tim Hudson, 32 years old to the end of his 33-year-old season just a couple years ago. That's four out of the top 10 finishers in ERA from 2007 and 2008. Significant stretches lost due to surgery. Extend that out to the top 15. That's the next five guys beyond the top 10. And you have Ben Sheets, Scott Kazmir, and Adam Wainwright, all of whom missed seasons due to injury. The healthy members of the list: CeCe Sabathia, Tim Lincecum, Dan Herron, Chad Billingsley, Cole Hamels, and Roy Halladay. The point? No point, really. Just that pitching injuries happen, and they happen obviously more often than they do to the lineup. It's the one peril of building your team around pitching, and it's one thing to keep in mind as the Phillies enter the season, relying on Cole Hamels, Roy Halladay, and Cliff Lee to stay healthy. Now, let's shift gears to football. Earlier today, I sat down with Les Bowen, our Eagles beat writer here at the Daily News and Philadelphia Sports Week, and we talked a little bit about the Super Bowl, but mostly about 48-year-old assistant coach Todd Bowles, whom the Eagles recently hired to fill the vacancy in their secondary. Most recently, he was the interim head coach in Miami after the Dolphins fired Tony Sperano. He had spent the previous four seasons as a secondary coach there, a lifelong secondary coach, a Temple alum. But an interesting hire because he has interviewed for head coaching positions over the past few years. He reportedly turned down the defensive coordinator position in Oakland and ended up signing with the Eagles. And this, of course, leads to the question, what exactly is the relationship between Todd Bowles and Juan Castillo? What exactly are the Eagles looking for out of Todd Bowles? He inherits a secondary that really has been overshadowed by the running game struggles. But for the type of star power that the Eagles have in their secondary, the results have been less than satisfactory. An 85.1 opposing quarterback rating, that ranked 19th in the NFL this year. 7.2 yards per attempt, that ranked 16th. 15 interceptions ranked just 15th. And they finished 24th in touchdown passes allowed. Last year, 29th in touchdown passes allowed. And in 2009, 24th in touchdown passes allowed. This from a secondary that features three cornerbacks who have combined for eight Pro Bowls: Dominique Rodgers-Cromartie, Nnamdi Asamoah, and obviously Asante Samuel. In spite of a defense that finished 2011 tied for the NFL lead with 50 sacks, which of course leads to the question, are the cornerbacks letting the secondary down? Is the coaching staff letting the secondary down? Or perhaps are the safeties letting the secondary down? I personally think the Eagles have two of the worst safeties in the NFL, especially when you take them as a tandem. Let me read some of these numbers down for you. Wes Welker against the Eagles this year: 8 catches, 115 yards, 2 touchdowns. Deion Branch, 6 catches, 125 yards, no touchdowns. Victor Cruz, game 1, 3 catches, 110 yards, 2 touchdowns. Game 2, 6 catches, 128 yards, 1 touchdown. Laurent Robinson, 5 catches, 103 yards. Earl Bennett, 5 catches, 95 yards, and a touchdown. And yes, Larry Fitzgerald, remember him? 7 catches, 146 yards, 2 touchdowns. Scheme, personnel, safeties, cornerbacks, secondary coach, defensive coordinator. One more stat to chew on. Yes, the Eagles finished first in the NFL with 50 sacks, but 31 of those sacks came in their 8 wins, only 19 came in their 8 losses, which suggests against good offensive lines or good quarterbacks, the wide nine alone simply was not up to snuff this year. Now, would a defensive coordinator besides Juan Castillo be the answer? Or have the Eagles simply been hurt by a lack of physicality and poor drafting? Let's talk to Les about Todd Bowles.
Les Bowen.
What do you think of Todd Bowles? Have you talked to him yet?
You know, I have not. I think Marcus Hayes has talked to him for our paper. I'm really, the thing that I'm interested in, the Eagles have never hired a guy who was a hot head coaching candidate,
right?
You know, to be on their staff. I mean, they've had guys like Dick Geron and Marty Morningweg who were coming to their staff from having been head coaches, but nobody was interviewing those guys to be a head coach at the time when they signed on with the Eagles. This is an up-and-coming coach who had 2 interviews for head coaching jobs in Miami and in Oakland this year. And I'm real curious about what his role is going to be. Andy kind of soft-pedaled that and, you know, made it clear he will be the secondary coach, Juan will be the defensive coordinator. But we don't really know how that's going to work out. And we see from Juan a guy who's pretty amenable to however Andy wants it to work out. I mean, if Andy wants Todd Bowles to have a very large voice in the kind of coverages the Eagles play and the adjustments they make, he will. You know, Juan's not going to put his foot down and say, hey, this is my defense. You know, that just isn't his personality. Not that he's not a forceful man, but he's so grateful to Andy and so humble and so, you know, so much a company guy that they can set this up however they want. So I'm very curious to see the mini camps and see what Todd Bowles is actually doing there, because this is a higher profile guy than they brought in previously.
At the risk of delving into unfair speculation, let me try to phrase it this way. Would the following situation surprise you or make sense, knowing the organizational mindset as you do? Juan Castillo enters 2012 with 4 or 5 games to prove himself, and Todd Bowles is waiting in the background. And everybody's first hope, obviously, is that Juan succeeds. But Bowles is very much a safety blanket in case Juan's struggles reoccur in the first month of next season?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I hadn't thought of it in exactly those terms. I would think if something like that played out, if the defense struggled early, you might see what you just described unfold in fact, if not in theory. I mean, they...
In terms of Bowles taking
over. They might actually have Bowles do that without making any real change, you know, without saying, hey, Juan's out of here. Still keep him there, but have Bowles, you know, do the job, basically. You know, I think they could get away with that. Probably nobody, you know, it would take us a while to find out. but, yeah, that's possible.
It's a weird situation because, as you noted, Bowles was the interim coach when Sperano was fired. He was a hot candidate elsewhere in the league, and yet the Eagles must have said something to convince him to sign on as secondary coach, no?
Well, I don't know. I mean, yes, you would think that, but on the other hand, the Ferris wheel had kind of gone around a few times, and he hadn't gotten he wasn't getting a head coaching job, and a couple of defensive coordinator jobs actually came and went that he didn't get. So we were almost to the point where he kind of needed a landing spot for a season, you know? I just don't have a good feel for that yet. I mean, maybe, but it's an interesting, I am really curious as to how it's all going to work, because the other thing is he's worked most recently in, most of his reputation has been made in 3-4 defenses, which,
right.
Now obviously as a secondary coach, that's not a huge concern, but nonetheless, that is his kind of pedigree as a defensive mind, you know, and the Eagles aren't going to play a 3-4 defense. So I don't know. I mean, if you're talking about him taking over the Eagles defense, you know, that becomes a bigger question. You know, he's a 3-4 guy primarily, you know. So
yeah, and it's not even like they have the personnel. I mean, they do.
No, they really, you know, they have some guys that would be interesting, like Brandon Graham.
Yeah, they have guys in the linebacking
corps. Nobody thought the Eagles would draft him because he was projected as a 3-4 linebacker coming out of college. But they really don't have
the linemen,
the defensive line that you would want for a 3-4.
I mean, you don't have that nose tackle to cover people up. You don't have those big defense. I mean, you don't have any big
defense.
Right,
and you're
wins.
Not going to play wide nine with Jim Washburn in a 3-4.
Right.
That would look very strange.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's an awkward situation for him to be stepping into, I would think. And it's an awkward situation all around, just given Andy's explanation of the Spagnuolo flirtation, given Lurie's explanation of Reed's situation, and given the fact that Bowles is clearly here for a reason.
I think you're absolutely right. It is an awkward situation. It's one that really cries out for some clarification, and we're not going to really get it until we see them on the field.
Well, you know, Juan will say the right thing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like I said before, you know, they could basically give Todd Bowles the job and just keep Juan around as a figurehead, and Juan wouldn't, Juan wouldn't do anything to embarrass them. We just don't know how it's all going to work. But I tell you, though, while I'm not a Juan apologist, and I said very forcefully in the paper that I felt they should go in a different direction, I don't see this defense being a catastrophe next season. The problem I have with Juan, after they got everything straightened out and he stopped trying to play that really complicated zone stuff and guys kind of knew where each other were going to be and things like that, they had a good defense. I mean, I don't think they're going to come out next year and be horrible defensively, especially if they draft a linebacker or sign a linebacker in free agency. You know, the problem I have with Juan is more on a nuance level, more on like, you know, Larry Fitzgerald is killing you in the fourth quarter.
Right.
How come Jaquan Jarrett is covering him? You know, and that's the sort of thing that I hope Todd Bowles can address. But if their defense is as bad as it was in the early going of last season, early this season, I'll be shocked. I mean, I just don't think that's going to happen, you know, regardless of Juan. I think the players are good enough and have a good enough idea of what they need to do, you know, to keep that from happening.
Finally today, we're going to turn our attention to a time period when the Eagles were actually, get this, good. When they went to 3 straight NFL championship games, 1947, 1948, and 1949, winning the last 2 of them. Steve Van Buren was the all-star, highest paid player in the NFL, Hall of Famer, number retired by the Eagles, and the subject of a new book by Daily News senior writer Will Bunch, who takes us inside both the Eagles and the city of Philadelphia in 1948 in Give It to Steve, an excerpt of which can be found in the Sports Week that hit newsstands 2 weeks ago. Some quick stats for you. 1948, Philadelphia played host to both the Republican National Convention and the Democratic National Convention. Thomas Dewey, he of the Dewey Decimal System. Actually, I don't know if that's true. I can't imagine. He did a lot of librarying. Former governor of New York was the GOP nominee besting Robert Taft. And the Democratic nominee was, of course, Harry S. Truman. He of the Enola Gay, and the buck stops here. It was the first conventions that were televised nationally, and they were held at Convention Hall. The Phillies that season finished 66-88. The Athletics, Philadelphia Athletics, 84-70, fourth in the American League. The Philadelphia Warriors, Wilt Chamberlain's Philadelphia Warriors, lost in 6 games to the Baltimore Bullets in the NBA final. To set the stage, Steve Van Buren, four-time NFL rushing champ, his number 15 retired by the Eagles, former All-American at LSU, rushed for 196 yards and a touchdown in that 1948 championship game, which was played in the snow here in Philadelphia.
Eagles beat the Cardinals, and then the following season went on to beat the Rams to repeat as champs. They would win just one more title up until now, 1960. This was a time of Truman Capote, of Albert Camus, of Gore Vidal, the House Un-American Activities Committee, the federal debt, $252 billion, unemployment, 3.9%, Philadelphia, population at an all-time high, 2.1 million, peaking at the 1950 census. And here he is, Will Bunch, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, and a guy who is writing about a period of time and a period of this city's history that fascinates me, Philadelphia in 1948. What was
absolutely
it like?
Absolutely. Hey, Dave, thanks for having me on. Well, you know, one thing I really want to get across in this piece is a couple things. I mean, the real dominant theme, I think, in 1948 was it was just 3 years after the end of World War II. And so a couple things. One thing is that very, very different from today, America was feeling really good about itself because, you know, we'd just beaten the Nazis. We had just beaten Japan. You know, the economy obviously got a huge jolt from World War II. And so the Great Depression, which had dominated the 30s, was clearly way in the rearview mirror. There were lots of jobs. You know, older Philadelphians may remember this is when the Philadelphia Navy Yard was really booming, and right. People were coming here from all over to work in the Navy Yard. There were other defense contractors like GE that had a big presence in Philadelphia that were hiring lots of folks. And there were lots of the city, the population of Philadelphia was bigger than it is now. It was over 2 million people, which was the all-time peak of the city's population. And a lot of that was veterans who'd come home from the war. A lot of them, like my father-in-law, for example, who was at LaSalle, came home and went to college on the GI Bill. Actually, you know, because you had these like 25-year-olds who were going back to school, you know, they had a little bit of free time and they had a couple dollars and sports was becoming a lot more popular in the 40s. Baseball attendance, maybe not in Philadelphia because the A's and the Phillies were pretty awful in the late 40s, but baseball attendance in other cities boomed during those years, and that's when the NFL really took off. So it was really an exciting time in those ways, and I think, you know, the NFL was really starting to reap kind of the benefits of this growing middle class and this increased earning. That was something. I mean the book. I want to make it clear. You know, Give It to Steve is definitely a football story, and it's it's about a great football game, and it really focuses on a great player, Steve Van Buren. But I think you'll also get kind of the tenor of the broader times in Philadelphia if you read it. So.
How big of an Eagles town was it back then? And again, the book it's essentially a novella. A nonfiction novella.
Let me just explain it real quick. It's called a Kindle single. You know, in the sense that a single is like a song versus a CD or an album.
Right.
I would say it's about 1/4 of the length of a regular book. So it's longer than a magazine article, but shorter than the book. You know, it's a quick read. You could, if you're into the topic, you could probably sit down and read it in one night. Not the commitment that a full-blown regular-length book would
be. Good, because I start sweating.
And it's priced accordingly. It's priced $1.99. One thing, and this is actually something I write about a lot, I write about some in the piece, is we kind of forget in our prism, is this was exactly the time that television was really coming into its own and becoming a big deal. And in fact, and I didn't realize this until I wrote the piece and did some research, but 1948 is really considered the year when you saw a huge growth in the number of Americans owning TV sets. And one thing, this one way of putting it just kind of sums up kind of the essence of why this game was such a turning point is the 1948 championship game was the last game played in leather helmets. A main focus of the whole piece is the story of Steve Van Buren, which is also just an incredible story. You know, especially the fact that this guy was a kid who spent the first 10 years of his life on this obscure island in the Caribbean off of Honduras. I mean, talk about an unlikely path to the NFL. And then ended up, his mother died and his father left, and he ended up raised by a grandmother in New Orleans during the depths of the Depression when everybody was pretty poor, and he dropped out of school and worked in an iron foundry for a couple years. And somehow, like against every possible odds, found his way to the NFL and became, you know, was the Jim Brown, Walter Payton, Eric Dickerson of his day, and then some. I mean, he won four NFL rushing titles in 8 seasons, retired as the NFL's all-time leading rusher at the time in the early 50s, just kind of revolutionized the role of the running back in the NFL.
Do you get any sense for what the fan base, Philadelphia is renowned for having this rabid fan base these days. Do you get any sense for when that came to be and how rabid they were back then?
Well, I think they started it. I mean, you know, Philadelphia in the 1940s was kind of like Philadelphia had came in more recent times, which was a city that was kind of starved for success or championship in sports. I mean, as I mentioned, the baseball teams had been terrible all through the mid-30s and 40s. The Eagles, as Eagles fans may know, they were a pretty awful second division team for pretty much the first 10 to 12 years of their existence. They never had a winning record until around the time Van Buren showed up with the 1945 season was his rookie year. So Philadelphia was pretty stark for a championship. And so when Van Buren and the Eagles delivered and they won the championship, in the game I write about in Give It to Steve, the 48 championship game. And then the next year they went out. It was funny. They played, they actually played three NFL championship games in a row, 47, 48, 49. Each one of them had a different kind of horrendous weather. So, the 47 game was a famous game that was played on a sheet of ice, in which the Cardinals ended up with the right kind of sneakers and the Eagles didn't, and they slipped all over the place and the Cardinals ended up winning the game. So, which made the 48 game that I focus on a real kind of revenge match just for that reason alone. And then, of course, the 48 game, played in the snowstorm. And then, in 49, they got to Los Angeles and they say, well, you know, Los Angeles, you're going to have great weather for that game. Right. And in fact, they were playing at the LA Coliseum, which seated 90,000 people, and they were anticipating this huge gate and the players, you know, the players got a cut of the gate for their winning or losing share of the championship game. And that was big money back then. I mean, now they don't even talk about that as a factor, but compared to their contracts, but back then getting the winner share or losing share of the championship game was a big deal. So they went out to Los Angeles in the Coliseum, and it turned out they had, you know, one of the worst like monsoons in LA history. It was like the field was like covered in an inch of mud, and it was like pouring rain, and only 22,000 fans showed up. And the Eagles won. Van Buren rushed for 196 yards and scored another touchdown. And they actually got less money than they had gotten from the game in the blizzard the year before in Philadelphia. So
how much money did these guys make back then, salary wise?
Well, typically a player might make like $2,500, $5,000 a year, which, there's a huge difference in the buying power of a dollar. So,
were they middle class, upper class?
Upper middle class, Van Buren did after the, in fact, I think this contract kicked in after they won their first championship, but, Van Buren did spend for a couple seasons and made $15,000 a year. So he was the highest paid player in pro football at that salary. But making $15,000 a year back then was like making $100,000 today or over $100,000. Just what Van Buren went through the play in the later years of his career. I mean, he said he would get shots of Novocaine sometimes a half dozen to a dozen times in a game. He said one time they even like injected him with morphine so he could play. He was that banged up, but yet he was still that determined to go out there and he paid the price. You know, I mean, he began to suffer memory loss at a pretty early age. In other conditions that certainly seem to be related to a trauma induced dementia from football. He also became addicted to the horse track. I mean, he went to Philadelphia Park basically every day of his life after his football career ended. A lot of research, it's complicated. It's hard to prove a cause and effect. I mean, there's a lot of research about, people with head injuries are much more prone to addictive behavior. So, I don't know, it's, It's kind of a sobering, in a way, it's a little bit of a sobering epilogue to the story, but I think it's a part of the story I couldn't leave out, you know.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So what do you think about the Phillies this year?
The Phillies. I hope they do well. I mean, I'm giving you the perspective of the perspective of fan emotion just for a second before talking about the actual, you know, team and its prospects. But just I think something really kind of not that great happened to diehard Phillies fans like me the last couple of years. The 07 and 09 and to some degree 09 were just great to see them come up and then win the championship, and even the loss to the Yankees in the World Series, I mean, they were just fun years and they were exciting. This is going to sound weird, but I almost enjoyed 07 when they won the division for the first time as much as I enjoyed 08, you know, just the ride on the way up. And then at some point, though, something happened where I think Phillies fans just became afraid of the Phillies losing, and it almost became like, I mean, the playoff series, the playoffs in the last couple seasons, seemed to be almost dominated by like fan dread of them losing, and then yeah. which was then verified by the ways that they actually did lose the way the fans dreaded they would, you know, and it was like, I think that almost had to happen to like just kind of purge the whole system. I can't speak for any other fans other than myself, but I know I'm just trying to go into the season without any expectations other than I just want to see good baseball and we'll see what happens and not expecting anything, even though clearly they're still an elite team in baseball. I mean, there's no doubt, and they won the most games, and you know, despite the playoffs, I mean, they won the most games in Major League Baseball the last two seasons, and a lot of the things that made them that kind of team are still there. So hopefully we'll see a pretty exciting year. But I think
I can hear the dread in your voice even as you're talking right now.
Absolutely. Well, what's interesting though is just as a comparison. I mean the way I feel about the 76ers right now is the way I felt about the Phillies in the like two or three years before they won the World Series in '08, and I mean this is like horrible to say, and I hope nobody thinks it's sacrilegious, but it's just more fun to root for the 76ers right now than it is to root for the Phillies.
There's a difference between winning.
Do you know any Phillies fan who had fun during that series with the Cardinals last year? People were terrified, and then their terror was justified in the end. So it was kind of a self-fulfilling experience.
It's like 2008 was fun because, I mean, I'm sure there's a whole lot of Freudian metaphors we could get into, but this is still a family podcast. But 2008 was your first time. It was your first one. It was it'll never feel like, you realize now that it'll never feel like that again, because so much of that feeling came from the fact that you had never felt it before. I mean, an entire generation of fans my age and younger had never consciously witnessed a sports championship before. I mean, I was 26 at the time that they won, and I was born in 1982, and the last time they had won was 1980. I hadn't even subconsciously been alive for a championship, and it was just so different, you know? It was so – just even covering it as a reporter, that you got this sense that you were covering some – you were covering history. You were covering stuff that somebody like you, like the 1948 game, would one day write about. And – it's almost like an addict where you know you're never going to – that high is never going to feel like it did the first time. But now it's like you're scared if you don't get that fix. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think clearly, I mean, to use your addict analogy, I think things clearly bottomed out in 2010 and 2011, you know, because then it was really – you know, I mean, the expectations on those teams were just so high. And, you know, especially last year after getting that rotation set up the way it was. I don't want to be so unrelentingly negative, because I think it's going to be a real interesting year. I mean, I think the last two seasons have brought fans' expectations maybe back to a slightly more realistic level. And like I said, they're still a very good team, although, it'll be interesting to see, the Marlins clearly improved a lot over the offseason. And I, I think I think the team over, maybe not this season yet, but I think over the long term, the team that actually scares me in the division is the Nationals. I never thought I would say that, but if Bryce Harper really is who he might be, when he joins Strasburg and the other pieces of the puzzle that they have in there, I think both the Nationals and the Marlins could be kind of long-term threats to the Phillies' dominance in this division. So I think there's a lot of they're actually. Having said that, there is kind of pressure this year before those teams get really, really good for the Phillies to try and make one more big line at it this year.
And that is our podcast for this week. I really appreciate you dropping by and letting us drop into your eardrums here at sportsweekphilly.com, Philadelphia Daily News. All of it's on newsstands or in your web browser right now. I am Dave Murphy, your host. Until next week, when we will be broadcasting from sunny Clearwater, Florida, I bid you adieu.
Not a game. You don't want to have a space mountain, you gotta get dirty, you gotta cock.